It's just past 18 hours, 30 minutes and 31 seconds East African time. Time for John Sibiokumu on Wednesday. This being Wednesday the 17th of May 2023. Hamjambo na karibuni, hello and welcome. Our hashtag for this edition will be Kenya at 60, that is from 1963 to 2023, the environment. Let's begin with some online definitions in the manner of a school debate. The environment is everything that is around us, which includes both living and non-living things, such as soil, water, animals and plants, which adapt themselves to their surroundings. Its basic components are the atmosphere, or the air, the lithosphere, or soil and rocks, the hydrosphere, made up of water, and the biosphere, which comprises all living things. Well, even if we don't know quite what the environment is in scientific terms, those of you listening are certainly aware that it is under severe threat, with dire implications for the very survival of our species. Our guest, a mystery till the near end, as you know, is a Kenyan who will have informed professional opinions on this topic, which we might well revisit again in another episode from another angle. But first, let's hear answers to the question with a deliberately negative slant. As citizens, what are we doing wrong to our environment? Je, ni kipi kibaya tunachokifanya kwa mazingira?
Stop littering. Trash inafaa kuwa kwa trash bin.
Well, it's simple. Not use plastic material like the plastic bands and all. Avoid deforestation.
Not throwing your litter around. That small paper could cause a big difference. It's obvious to say we should stop littering and all, but I think it's high time we start coming up with innovations such as energy systems that do not emit harmful gases to the air. We can maybe start by kutumia electronic cars na tupunguze sound pollution.
Just stop illegal dumping, like throwing of birds carelessly.
In our up countries, there are no set rules or guidelines on how people should replace or take care of the environment, since most of them use firewood.
So, Dada, what do you make of that?
Informed, responsible, understandable are basically the first words that come to me. Mainly because we hear a lot about what we as individuals can do. And almost everybody I heard talked about what I as an individual can do. I think your third respondent was interesting and instructive. Few people point out to the role that government and policy could make, because mazingira yetu kweli is not only a personal responsibility. The role of government is crucial here.
Okay, well, there's somebody who's saying there that isn't this wishful thinking that we should be into the age of the electric car? Isn't just that awful aping of the West scenario, whatever's good for others is good for us? We're nowhere near.
I've come to the conclusion that a lot of these responses are metaphors. I love that response because it points to the fact that there's something bigger than just throwing or picking up my trash that will change the environment or save the environment. There's something bigger. And in her response, it's an electric vehicle. That may not be the Kenyan response, but it is somewhere. But there's something beautiful about the scale that is implied there.
You're very kind. I would like to draw away. There's lots of statistics in my research around this topic of preserving the environment, but I'd like to draw you to the effect of a value system. So, for example, we see people traveling from here to the coast or here from Kisumu, And the idea is that they just sort of bung through things out through the window. It is a national culture to throw our litter around and let somebody else take care of it.
You're right. I mean, the question was whether what it is we are doing. So we know what's going wrong. Whether we are doing the right thing ourselves with our actions match is a whole different story. So you're right. We see it, and it drives me crazy every time you're driving behind some.
But just one minute. I think you could say something, because you're well traveled. I think that part of the reason when you blame people for doing things is that they don't know how to do any better. So do we have a signage system? Is there telling me as a citizen at every turn, throw your litter away? When I do have litter, is it possible for me to find some dustbins in which to throw it? And then there's the lady, the young lady who's being very sort of personal, saying, I'm a woman, we must sort of find a proper way to deal with our sanitary pads. Now, I think that's quite brave of her to have said that, because normally it's like, you know, it's a taboo subject, these things are not used, we don't know what they're on about. But I'm saying that there is a lacuna there about education, civic education.
Absolutely. It speaks to what we are taught, how we are taught it, and when we are taught it. What I find fascinating is most, at least Kenyans I know, we have these discussions all the time. When we are out of the country, we have a completely different mindset about this. It has nothing to do with whether we know it or not. We all know that it's terrible to litter. I don't think anybody leaves the house thinking, I cannot wait to litter along the way as I'm going. What it is there are probably no consequences immediately to that littering. And as a result, we do it, and we do it as if someone were watching. And I often do this. Sometimes if someone litters when I'm around them, I will tap them on the back and say, hey, I think you dropped something, you know, and that catches them. If you look at the response, it's an embarrassment, but also they often will always pick it up. So it is a mindset. It is about the education when we are taught that, but it is also about the consequences. There are no consequences to littering generally. And I think there was a time actually in Nairobi in the last 10 years when we were told you cannot litter. And in fact, the litter bins were everywhere, and we saw a lot more responsibility. It wasn't as much litter. I think that it just takes a little bit of responsibility, personal responsibility, yes, but there needs to be a place for me to throw that trash, and then there needs to be some consequences. I've never met anyone who loves to litter. I think people do
it. I'm sure they don't, but would it be a bit extreme? The sort of, I've never been there, but the mythology has it that Lee Kuan Yew of Singapore, I mean, if you so much as threw down a piece of chewing gum, you were in for the high jump and you paid a huge fine. So in other words, I think we suffer in Nairobi where we live, we suffer with our policemen trying very hard to catch us doing something right or wrong, more wrong, so that they can take a bribe. But you could be told that you've parked your car in the wrong place, you've parked for too long, but nobody does anything to you. I know you've said it before. Can we call for legislation? Because everybody who's been on this program before, Dada, says that we, the people, we own this joint. The Constitution is ours. We're managing it. But how do we complain about laxity in governance?
Yeah, we have to. We have to actually push for that. We have, you don't even have to go to Singapore. Look at Rwanda. I've been to Kigali a few times, and every time I'm in Kigali, I am ashamed of how unconsciously I find trash all over my streets in Nairobi. But when I'm in Kigali, it is spotless, and I never would ever consider trashing, or you don't see anybody.
You know what, Dada, if you read something in the Western press, that is a manifestation of dictatorial rule. There's that whole narrative rubbishing the Rwandan government for being dictatorial.
Well, that's,
in other words, telling its people what to do.
But
so
listen,
part of democracy might be, please throw some rubbish because you're free to do so.
I think we leave that to the Rwandans. to decide. The truth of the matter is, how is it working for them? How is it working? If you talk to Rwandans today, and I talk to many of them, they love what the streets of Kigali say about them, how they feel when they walk in the streets of Kigali and they feel that it's clean. They love Umuganda when they clean the streets every
and once I believe a month. There's a time every so, Saturday. I think President Kagame comes out with his broom
and joins the rest of them.
Unless that's changed.
I wish we would just copycat.
And when you get off the airplane as well, one of the things that you mustn't do in Rwanda is to lug about some plastic. They make it quite clear at the beginning. But I think without sort of ratting on ourselves and who sneaked on us and all the rest of it, Kenyans came down heavily on plastics, which was mentioned by one ANCHI on.
They did.
But am I right in saying, Dada, that it's creeping back slowly, slowly, as we like to say, poly, poly.
We mustn't let it. But it is.
Where do you shop? Where do you shop?
I shop all over the place.
So you reckon that since Judy Wahungu and her great edict, plastic is no more?
I wouldn't say plastic is no more. I think we've made significant progress. I see a lot more kiondos and baskets and palm frond baskets than I've seen before. So we just have to keep on. And every flight I come in from outside, they announce that Kenya does not allow plastic. Please don't take your plastic in. That policy is still in place. Enforcement perhaps a little lax. We can do better. But I wouldn't say we've crept back to the old days. We see much less trash on our streets today, much less plastic flapping in the trees than we did in the past.
Thank you. I'd like to the remark from the, about the countryside, and this all has to do about the culture, the way we were, the way Africans, by our very nature, respected our environment. But there was a voice that was saying that there needs to be an education in the countryside, because I think firewood was mentioned. And again, I declare an interest. Where I come from, the major source of cooking fuel, whatever the English word might be, is firewood.
As it is. And I don't think, actually, there are some really good voices and research. I come from a research organization at WRI, where we know that firewood as a fuel is going to be very difficult to replace. We are going to see firewood for a very long time. The real question is, where does that firewood come from? Where does that charcoal come from? Can we create...
And is the source inexhaustible?
Well, we
I mean, we read about somebody
build.
Who's built a new type of Jiko, and this will cook for 1,000 hours before being depleted.
That's all good progress. Yeah. We need good technology. We need good Jikos. We need good technologies to burn that fuel.
But we also need firewood here forever.
It is here for a long time, and it has actually been demonized more than it needs to. What we need to do is not cut down our forests for firewood, not cut down our forests for charcoal, but let's plant trees on farms. Let's make a business of trees for firewood and charcoal. We know this happening for tea, for coffee. Why not for charcoal and why not for firewood? So that people make a living. It is one of the most profound fuels I have ever seen. You go to a country like Morocco where they bake bread every day, and those charcoal ovens are difficult to replace. It's going to be critically important part of their culture. What we must say is not stop baking your bread. We must say is, can we find more sustainable sources of wood and charcoal?
Well, thank you very much. That's a good start referring back to what you've heard. We're about to take a break, but I want you to think as you sit, and I'm going to hit you with some jargon. I've done my sort of Inspector Clouseau Hercule Poirot research on this. I don't know much about it. But I'll hit you with some of the jargon phrases that attach to this particular topic. And I'd like you to respond.
Karibu.
Thank you. Capital FM. Dada, you must know this, about 65% of Africa's farmland is degraded, worn down by unsustainable farming and grazing practices. Forests, grasslands, and other lush landscapes are also facing rapid damage, yielding to water insecurity and growing deserts. Without urgent action, the soil will yield less and less food, posing a serious problem for the 60% of people across Africa who rely on the land to feed their families. What's Kenya doing about that wonderful, horrible phrase?
It's a terrible phrase, you're right. But, you know, I think Kenya, we must congratulate ourselves for the ambition that we've set to, you know, the president and the Ministry of Environment are absolutely committed to a reforestation agenda that is unprecedented, right? How do we restore to productivity soils that are depleted because of too much fertilizer, because we are not circulating the agricultural practices, we are not engaging
Dada, please, I could have had a politician here. You've just fertilizer, if I was reading my papers, is one of the things that was promised, that people would be getting fertilizer to make them produce more.
Yes, now you're fertilizer, trying to suggest but how much? We have to use fertilizer judiciously, because too much of a good thing is dangerous. So fertilizer is no different. We have sometimes overused chemical fertilizer, and that's what you mean, what you hear people saying, the soils can no longer produce the yields they used to produce. There is too much of a good thing like fertilizer, so we have to be more focused in how much fertilizer is used. So fertilizer is absolutely one of those. I'm not saying we don't need it,
well,
but
we have to use the thing is, we've got to move on in a program such as this. There's so much that I could sort of keep on challenging your every phrase, but you know, I keep on thinking about the human being. I'm thinking about my aunties and, you know, their various clans, you know, but who don't have an idea of, first of all, the effect of fertilizer on their production, who second of all don't have the money to buy fertilizer. And there you are saying, you know, use it judiciously. It's like telling
Absolutely.
Me to change my toothpaste.
Absolutely. No. For those who don't have, they're probably doing even better, because they have better ways of enriching the soils. They have organic fertilizers. They probably have a cow, a goat. They have all sorts of biomass that they use on their farm. So your auntie's doing very well if she's not using much fertilizer. But this is the truth. We have got to make sure that our farmers are well informed. And this is one of our the things our government is doing, is ensuring that people are using whatever resources they have and using them appropriately. That's a crucial part of our agricultural agenda. So yes, tell auntie to continue using less fertilizer and continue using more cow dung and goat and other manure.
Okay, we have to move on. There's never enough time. We should have a three-day conference for this. Created in September 2014, the Landscape Restoration Technical Working Group, the LRTWG, identified the most pressing land use challenges currently affecting Kenya, as well as a list of restoration options that could help address these challenges. Very quickly, you explain to me what is meant by what I read. Bullet point number one, reforestation and rehabilitation of degraded natural forests. And to warn you, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 bullet points, maybe 6.
Yes.
Reforestation and rehabilitation, what does that mean?
Replanting trees in areas that once were forests. We know forest boundaries. They have very clear designated boundaries, and many of those are depleted. So we've got to re-tree.
So, okay, from the little that I know, the Mau Forest is going to be restored to its former glory by government decree. Would you go so far as saying that without sort of losing your job?
It's a lot more complicated than that. Even with not my job notwithstanding, it is a lot more complicated. We have settlements in the Mau. We have all sorts of things going on. So it's not as easy as restore.
Which were created, ill-created in the first place.
Yes, a lot of them.
We've got to go back and sort of, things were better before. We've got to go back to the way things were.
Well, you know,
rather than move to the way things should be.
We've got to be pragmatic where human life is concerned. There's some settlements in there, and some of those, there's going to be very little we can do. Let's talk about restoring and replanting in areas where we actually can. And that's important because every bit of forest counts. And by the way, you can create new forest areas. You don't have to always go back to where you were. So you can expand forest areas based on plantation places where you have commercial plantations. So,
but Dada, this is a political gambit. If I want everybody in that kind part of the world to vote for me, I'll say, look, folks, keep on building your, you know, because I want the votes.
Well, you have to be politics a good politician. Yes. If you're a good politician, you'll tell the people the truth, your position notwithstanding. You're not there for yourself. You're there to serve. And so service sometimes comes at a cost. The truth must always be told. So I think that's really important. Constituents like us like to hear the truth.
Sorry, I have to move on. I wish I could stay longer. Agroforestry and woodlots on cropland.
Well, agroforestry.
Jargon phrase for what?
It's not so jargony. Don't worry. These are very accessible statements. Agroforestry is about farming and planting trees in the same area. You have crops and trees, and so people who practice agroforestry have trees and food crops in the same place, even animals, on farm mainly. And woodlots, like I said, charcoal and firewood need not be produced in commercial forests or in indigenous forests. They can be produced in woodlots. These are farms of trees.
Farms of trees. Just a comment again from the layman's perspective that if you plant something like eucalyptus, there are certain trees which are sort of like awful. Oh, my goodness. They're not traditional and they're going to drain the soil and take 50,000 liters of water per day.
Not entirely. But eucalyptus planted in the wrong place is a disaster. You don't plant it in your conservation areas. However, in a woodlot where they are being planted for poles, telephone poles, or for fuel, why not? So there are what we say appropriate trees in the appropriate places.
Commercial tree and bamboo plantations. So commercial means grow trees for money. And I believe that if you grow a big shamba and are fighting carbon emissions, then you've already got the land to plant the trees. Therefore, you're rich. You're making yourself even richer by planting some trees, which will make sure that your grandchildren will never starve. And my poor auntie is still waiting for the desert to encroach her little half an acre, quarter of an acre plot.
Well, must always remember, we still need timber for the timber industry. In fact, here we are in the studio and I can count how many wooden things I can see. Timber is an important part of the sector. So commercial tree plantation is about trees for commercial exploitation. That's important. And of course, bamboo is one of the new miracles of the timber industry because of the fact that it's a grass and it keeps growing even as you cut it.
But if I save the money and catch the bust, where am I going to see huge plantations of bamboo?
Well, you suddenly see them in the mountains, so that's not where you're going to be harvesting them, but there are many people now growing bamboo commercially right here in Muranga, 2 hours away. The Greenbelt Movement has introduced a spectacular 12-acre bamboo plantation to help demonstrate that this is a viable commercial crop, but also one for fuel.
Okay, we're doing well. Tree-based buffers along waterways, wetlands, and roads.
Nothing.
And again, I hope you just love naysayers and devil's advocates, because when I see that word roads, I say we are in Nairobi. I happen to live in Nairobi. In the building of the expressway, every single jacaranda that made Nairobi something akin to a city like in South Africa, Pretoria, has been cut down. I see no efforts to. There's a big gap in the middle. Nobody's gone there to plant some new ones. And currently, if the capital city is an index of activity to come, Dad, we are busy cutting every tree down.
Please protect them wherever you see them.
Don't let it happen.
Yeah,
well, how we came back to the human angle. What am I to do? The elephant in the room is that I'm being told that I am the one who is actually at the source of running my country. Yeah. Now, to whom do I complain? Should I write to Governor Sakaja and say...
Yes, daily. Say you are upset.
And who's going to give my letter to him?
You will. He's very accessible. Today you have more channels
to reach Governor Sakaja than anybody else.
And he listens. No. I happen to know he listens.
Seriously,
but let me say
seriously,
this.
Seriously, we're cutting trees down. We're not growing trees.
We are cutting trees down, and that's part of the policy effort that we hope will be put in place. It was a tragedy to see 3,000 plus trees go down in the building of the expressway. Many of us tried to talk about alternatives. But it's also about planning. If we have a master plan, any country, any city should have a master plan. I happen to have seen master plans for certain cities for the next 100 years. They know where the roads will be built. They know where the buffer zones will be. And we need those trees in buffer zones, as you mentioned, tree-based buffers, because they protect, for example, rivers from the flows of garbage coming in. They help cool down cities. Nothing is more important today in the age of climate change than trees in cities. You go anywhere in a building in Nairobi that is high enough and you will be inspired by how green it is. But as you say, I hope it stays that way. The truth is, those buffers are important to our survival in the cities today. But it takes policy. There isn't much that individuals can do alone. But of course, I have to say, I was very inspired by activists during the building of the expressways who tried to stop the cutting of trees, and some symbolic trees were saved. But we would hope that our policies will protect every standing tree. Some of these trees are 200 years old. We don't have any right to cut them obvious. So I would say we build around them. There are cities that are building through them. There should be a price to the trees. And I know in cities like New York, if you want to cut a tree, they will ask you to pay the bill. If it's a 200-year-old tree, you're paying a lot.
Okay, we've got about a minute, maybe. Silvo Pastoral and Rangeland Restoration. I was thrown by that word, Silvo.
Well, Silvo, both referring to animals and agriculture in the same space. So silvo means you're integrating farming with livestock, and grazing, of course, is grazing animals. So one of the largest reasons why landscapes are degraded, believe it or not, is overgrazing. There is such a thing as overgrazing, where animals are consuming in one particular area, not rotating, not allowing for the recovery of landscapes. So this is something that needs to be done. And in places where it's done well, animals are happy and the landscape is happy.
Thank you very much. We have to stop for a second or two.
The best mix of music, Capital FM.
Dada, the National Forest and Landscape Restoration Opportunity Assessment seeks to provide a roadmap to implement Kenya's 5.1 million hectare commitment, as well as assist with national restoration targets laid out in the Kenya Constitution, that is achieving a minimum of 10% tree cover. Now, what does that mean? Have we achieved 10%? Are we about to achieve 10%? Are we adding 9 to 10? When I was a kid, I was told that Kenya was 23% of our country was arable. That, if you want to know when it was, is some in the early 60s, mid-60s. Is it more or less now?
Well, it's less. I mean, we haven't achieved 10%. 10% is the metric that's given for sustainable development. We need 10% for a country to be healthy, for the landscape to be sustainable. We are not at 10%. We are not anywhere near 10%, but that's also because we're talking forest cover. When you talk tree cover, today we know in Kenya there are more trees outside forest than in forest. And so that's part of the challenge of our reforestation agenda, is we need to restock our forests. We need to restore the integrity of our forests, because they are the water towers. They are the life-sustaining, life support systems that we depend on for water, for, you know, as we are hearing, over 5 years of continuous drought, our aquifers are down. And that's also because when water comes down, it runs off instead of going into the underground water aquifers. So we need them. We need those forests.
Another little anecdote that pertains to me personally, and I'm ratting on my people, but now it's the rainy season. I get reports that it's possible for rain to come down in over 4 hour periods, torrential rain, pelting down. It's coming now, it's been doing so for the last 2 months or so. It'll stop doing so, and then we'll have a huge period of drought. Then we'll be in the papers about having drought. Then we'll be in the papers, oh my goodness, these poor people, they're being flooded again. What are organizations like yours? What is the government doing to educate the Mwananchi to take charge of all this water that goes down in great, I don't know what the English word might be, but we're not behaving like the Egyptians are with their treasure cherishing of water. We're not behaving like the Israelis. We're saying let it all flow into the Indian Ocean.
Well, we should. We should be thinking crucially about our water systems. And, you know, what we have, because we're not a desert, we're very lucky that we have water towers. We have forests. And water is supposed to go down. That's what happens. It rains and water goes down. But we must admit that there is something going on that's different. We're having much heavier rains. We're having a lot more sustained downpours that are volumes are almost like buckets. This is unusual, and of course we know it's linked to climate change. But what we can do is harvest that water. That is all water we could use. We shouldn't allow it to go.
But how a water tank 10,000 liters equals approximately Kenya shillings 80,000 only.
Well, it cannot be
left to the
individual.
In an economy where we're forever being told that every Kenyan lives on, not every, a great percentage on less than $2 a day.
Well, it cannot be left to the individual. And that's why I'm saying it's a much bigger issue. It's a policy issue as well. There was a time in Kenya where we had extension workers. And I hope there will come a time when your aunt will say that actually we were visited by someone before the rains came, and we dug trenches that directed any down flows of water into the farm or down into this direction. There needs to be a bigger plan. We cannot leave all these efforts to the individual. It's expensive, as you say. But yeah, we could harvest at the farm level, at the family level. We could harvest some of that water. But it's coming down in much greater torrents.
Well, my poor auntie, the only blessing here is that I'm pretty sure she's not listening to this show for various reasons, but so she's not being picked on. The reduction of CO2 emissions, we're meant to take credit for having reduced them by 3.7%, according to the document which I read. Now, could you expand a bit to the layperson on this idea of CO2 emissions and their reduction and Kenya's place in the struggle?
Well, your auntie is welcome anytime. The emissions issue for Kenya and for many countries like ours has a lot more to do with emissions from cooking, emissions from burning, not so much, and of course emissions from motor vehicles. And that pollution is not only bad because of climate, it is terrible for our health. And that's why we must also care. It's not only because of the climate that we're doing this, because actually Kenya and many countries like ours are not responsible for significant amounts of emissions. That particular emission effort has to do with how we cook. And like you mentioned, the technologies, the cooking technologies that are being introduced are part of what Kenya has decided will be an intervention to cut down pollution. We know today that actually indoor air pollution is a great determinant of outdoor air pollution. So that's one. The second is cars on roads. I have never seen a situation where the traffic gets worse and worse and worse like in our. Every year, we are, I think, adding thousands of vehicles. What happened to our public transportation systems? What happened to our buses? When I grew up, we used to take buses from South Sea. We would go to town. I would go to school all by bus. We need to look at mass transit. That's also another way of cutting emissions. So Kenya has made some very deliberate decisions. And every country in the world, by the way, has made these calculations. Kenya's 3.7, and that's our contribution to the global effort.
Dada, in your line of activity, in creating a blueprint for Nirvana, these buzzwords always come up, and I see them again, reading about restoration, reforestation. One of them is capacity building, develop capacity. Everybody likes doing that. How do we go about it in this particular field?
Developing capacity. Well, I guess we all use those buzzwords because we have to communicate to certain people. But I think there's a very clear
donors.
Indication, donors included.
Yeah, yes.
Donors included. But we have to appreciate that we cannot expect people to do restoration without the support that's needed, without the structures that they need, HR systems, without finance systems to manage the resources they get. You know, what is exciting today is that we are investing bigger and bigger amounts of money in small organizations that historically were left out. They were left out because they didn't have the quote-unquote capacity. What we are saying is that's the wrong approach. We've got to build that capacity and ensure that people can absorb the resources. This is a great, great shift in the way philanthropy is working, that we are beginning to invest in those who are doing the hard work, those who are at the grassroots, and not saying that we'll only give money to those who have shiny reports and can speak great English.
We must deploy finance.
I guess that's exactly what I said. Deploying finance is getting the money where it's needed. You know, before M-Pesa, it was very difficult to get money to the mamamboga at the grassroots. So this deploying finance is taking every opportunity we have to not say we couldn't get the money there, but rather to ask, how do we get the money there? I'm excited about the fact that financial inclusion is such a big thing now. You almost can't say you can't pay someone in Nyeri, where I'm from. Yes, you can. There are multiple ways to do that today and send significant amounts of money. That's deploying finance.
Secure policy.
Well, we've talked a lot about not putting the blame on individuals and not making it our responsibility as individuals to do everything. We've got to identify, while we are doing what we're doing and restoring and protecting and doing the hard work, and what policies should be in place to incentivize what I'm doing. How can we make sure, for example, that forests and green spaces in our cities get permanent protection? Why should we be fighting every term when a new leader comes in place and say, please keep these green spaces intact? We should get permanent protection for some of them. That's policy.
Right. Okay. But I would say to you again, this is the idea of writing down what needs to be done. But could you cite from your own insider knowledge a piece or two pieces or three pieces of policy that have made a significant difference to our approach to this topic? Remember, in the last 60 years, we're looking at Kenya at 60. Do you have the historical background to the struggle?
Well, absolutely. I would say the most significant piece of legislation with respect to Kenyans and all of us was the Constitution, which in 2011, the amendment, gave us the right to a clean and healthy environment. That was significant, because remember, a decade or so before that, when people were trying to fight to protect the Uhuru Park and other green spaces, they lost a court case on the basis of locust. They did not have a locust standard. There was no legal basis for them to take that case to court. That was tragic, and we could have lost important green spaces. Today, every Kenyan has a right to a clean and healthy environment, constitutional right. That's massive. That gives us a lot of control. And that has, one could argue, been responsible for protecting a lot of green spaces.
Dada, let me put you on the spot. If again, talking to the one Aichi, if you were a politician, and maybe you're not, but if you, could you just say what you think is the most important thing? Could you address a gathering in Nyeri or Muranga or Kisumu and deliver what you've just said in Kiswahili?
In Kiswahili.
Yeah, what would you say to them?
Well,
what would you say, my dear auntie, what would you say to her?
To your dear auntie, I might say, actually... You know, first of all, in Nyeri is where...
Oh, you might say
one
in
of
Kikuyu,
the,
but we're not allowed to do that.
Kuna mfumo unaoitwa shamba system, ambayo ilikuwa inatumiwa sana na serikali yetu. Wakulima wanaoishi karibu na misitu, ilikuwa wanaweza kukuza mazao yao ya chakula, na kwa wakati huo huo huku wakikuza miche ya kupandwa kwa misitu. Lakini tunajua baada ya miaka mitatu walikuwa ni wahame, watoke kwa hizo misitu. Ubaya ni ya kwamba huo mfumo haukutekelezwa vile ilikuwa inahifadhika. Lakini kwa hivyo tukaona serikali ikasema tokeni. Lakini sio serikali ilisema tokeni kwa msitu. Tunajua kuna MP mmoja alisema tokeni kwa msitu. Na akatolewa kama mbunge. Lakini alisimamia huo mradi. Akasema kama hatutaendeleza hiyo mfumo na kuendeleza ya kupanda hizo miti na kuwa kukuza mifugo yetu, basi tutatoka kwa msitu. I would be like that MP. Tokeni kwa msitu kama hamta timiza huo mfumo.
Time is not on our side. Monitor, report, verify, and learn. I guess you're going to say that success in this particular field of endeavor is very, very easy to calculate. It's not like culture and the arts. And is that what you'd say? So you are monitoring progress.
Well, you're monitoring for, and anybody should monitor. Everybody should monitor, because what difference is your investment making? Governments monitor because they want to make sure that whatever investments they make, the difference that is seen in 5, 10, 20 years is attributable to the investment they made. You cannot make a statement like, this is what we achieved, if you did not monitor and do appropriate baseline studies to say, this is where we started, this is where we've ended, and this is the investment we made. That's what monitoring is about, reporting
does
and
that,
verifying.
It doesn't involve me at this stage as the one ancient. I'm not monitoring and reporting and verifying.
Well, if we're
I'm
using,
let off the hook. You're doing all that for me.
Well, no, if you are very much a part of the monitoring, reporting especially, a lot of that data is collected from you, the Mwananchi. And we are learning from what those data tell us. So we have to continue looking back. What good is it if 10 years from now we find out that actually we should have been going left instead of right? We learn every time we collect data, we look at those data and we say, we're learning something. Don't forget, that data is stories we're getting from communities, visits that we're making to see you and see how things are going. Coming to see how you're actually practicing. You could tell me that in HIV interventions that you're drinking your medicine. But when I come, I find that actually you've not been drinking your medicine. Can you imagine if I didn't come and I just kept counting how much medicine I'm sending? Really important to verify and to monitor and to report and to learn. Maybe it's difficult what I'm asking you to do, and we need to make adjustments. This is crucially important because we've got to be able to say we are making a difference. We are having an impact. And you cannot just say that from the air.
Thank you very much. One last break. Dad, I've reached that point in our conversation where I've got all my recorded notes. I've gone through them. And you know, like the politician who's chatting away and says, now I'm going to abandon my prepared speech. And then everything goes downhill from there. So off the cuff, unprepared, I'd like to ask you, knowing what you do, about our relationship with, for want of a better word, forces outside Kenya. And the West, the East, the because we're called what are they called, the South or the something,
the global south
yes. And maybe this is like a, first of all it was the first world, the second world, the third world, then we were developing nations, then we were emergent nations. Now it's quite quaint, because although my map of the world doesn't say so, we are part of the global south. The question is, Dada, just to what extent are we driving the agenda, and to what extent are we being told what to do? Otherwise, there's no money. Is there a sort of IMF type, or the moral equivalent in the world, or AFDB, somebody telling us what to do?
I love the fact that it's shifting. That has been, at least. I've never been in there. You're probably closer to politics than I am. You'd make a good politician, by the way.
Oh, my goodness.
I wouldn't. However, I know that what's shifting is extremely inspiring. To listen to African heads of state say they're tired of being shuttled around, of being essentially responding to others. There is a fascinatingly exciting narrative emerging. And if you listen to President Ruto recently on the energy agenda, you ought to be inspired. Kenya as a green industrialization hub, the climate discussions going on around the world today are demanding that countries in the north, you called us south, so countries in the north reduce emissions significantly. Decarbonize is the cliche word for this. That effort must be matched by an industrialization agenda in the south. We have, in Kenya, for example, we can speak for Kenya. Kenya has a grid, an electricity grid that is largely renewable already. 90% of our energy is green. Imagine what that means for manufacturing, where you embed, you build and manufacture using green energy. That's the future. We happen to be at the forefront of that. By God's grace, you might say, whatever the reason, our head of state has made that the priority. And that in today's agendas, in today's economic development agenda, is essentially setting the agenda ourselves. That is putting us in the forefront. I think we're going to see a time when we are in the front of manufacturing, and what we need, what we will need, is market access, because nobody has this. Our energy grid that is as green as it is the envy of the North.
More on the same topic, to draw you more. When I, in researching you in particular, every single forum that you are most vocal and which is recorded online is outside this country. Is that a terrible accusation? Would you say that's true?
I wouldn't call that an accusation.
It's the truth.
I am making the case for us.
Yes.
Wherever I can. And a lot, right, of the forums where these discussions are happening are outside our country. Except
that's why
I am excited to report to you,
yes,
that in September 4th to 6th, Kenya will host the Africa Climate Summit and the Africa Climate Week, which will bring that same cohort of people you're talking about I visit right here to Nairobi. You will hear my voice on the same agendas here. So I think it's sort of fair to say, because you may hear more of them outside, but we equally have platforms where we make those cases here. And by the way, in the last 3-4 years, a lot of those forums are virtual. So we do them. We may be heard there, but we're doing them from here.
That I do hear that, you know, the big plan is to make sure that in the next so many years, this idea of restoration, that 56.1 million hectares are going to be restored. The little four-year-old kid was saying, what about the Sahara Desert that it takes 4 hours to cross in a plane? It's been there for a long time, and it's actually getting closer. every year, that, every 10 years.
Right. Is
that a contradiction in terms?
No, we are not trying to restore the Sahara Desert. We are trying to prevent the Sahara Desert from expanding southwards.
Right.
And so that's why we have the great...
So tough luck to the guys in the desert.
No, the deserts...
That's
do what
problem.
Deserts do. We must ensure the integrity of deserts. In fact, deserts are only a disaster right now because they're expanding south and destroying communities that are not in the desert. The desert, we're not trying to turn the desert green. You'll never be able to convert a desert into a forest. We do have a buffer zone. You talked about buffers earlier, that is going from Dakar to Djibouti, the Great Green Wall. That is a wall of vegetation at the buffer between the desert and the landscapes that begin in Niger and some of those countries. That buffer zone will prevent the expansion of the desert. But let's make no mistake about it. There are some landscapes that will not be forested, grasslands, glades in the forest. Those are landscapes with integrity of their own, with biodiversity of their own. We can't turn everything into a forest. We must, however, ensure where there are forests and what those forests, the forests that exist, that they have the integrity. They actually have trees in them, the biodiversity that's required. But we're not saying take the Congo forest and put it in the desert. That would be a disaster.
Dada, time for me to ask you, who you are? Who are you?
Wanjira Maathai. I'm a climate and environment activist and a community builder.
Well, of course, I know that. What the listeners don't know is that this is a sort of weirdo conversation with me, because the very first person that I talked to, I knew both your parents. I knew your father because of his attachment to a magazine called Awaz, for whom I was a columnist.
That's right.
And I interviewed Mum. Because everybody, King Charles is calling his, Prince William is calling his dad Pa, so we can say Mum.
Exactly.
Mum, on a program called The Summit. And times have moved on, because your mum was very obliging to us. You know, we all met her. My wife was my PA. And so we spent some time, and everybody went completely gaga on the set.
Yes.
Because Wangari Maathai had come. And one thing that she accused us of then is that she didn't realize that, you know, the press, because they'd given her a hard time. And she said, why? I said, well, I'm doing a series of the most influential Kenyans of the last century, and you're one of them. So I've told my bosses, if we don't have Wangari, we don't have anybody.
Right.
And then we spoke together at the same forum, and she gave her Weaver Bird speech, and it was an educational. So I knew her well. So it's sort of sentimental to chat to you. I didn't know you existed at the time, but obviously you did. Otherwise, you wouldn't
I
be
did,
here.
Right.
One of the things that Mum said when we had our conversation then, I said to her, you know, it seemed to me that you're doing everything that you're doing in Nyeri. And like I said, I'm not Jesus Christ. Let other people solve their own problems. Let them sort out their own problem and growing trees. I'm going to deal with my own people, with our own problems. Would you agree with Mum?
I think she obviously tongue-in-cheek said that, because what we know is that she had to start somewhere. That was the place she knew. That was where she was from. She honed it. And today we know the Greenbelt movement is a vast network across the country. Some of the most prolific work going on in the Mount Elgon area, in the coast. And I mean, it is amazing what the movement has done. But what I admired about her is she started from where she was. That may be the most important lesson. Take a bite from where you are.
The other weirdo thing, talking about politics and government, is there she was with all her degrees, the first African woman to have gone on the airlift to the US and come back with a doctorate. But the politicians saw fit not even to make her the Minister for the Environment. So that we have this idea of that to take her as a national hero was an imposition. Kenyans of their own right weren't going to give her that consecration.
We are interesting, but I think she was well ahead of her time. She saw things that we didn't see. Today, I think it would be different. She did actually get quite a bit of support, but we all know that the political economy in a place is not a straight line. It yes. is not as if you, because of all the things you've done, because you are celebrated everywhere in the world, then it follows that this will happen. No, it doesn't. Political economy is what it is.
But have you, as an individual, Wanjila, have you gone to the white side, not the dark side, and now sort of steered well clear of government? I'm sure you have coffee and tea with all the cabinet, and you go to look for money abroad. Is that?
No, listen. Politics in I've come to realize in my career is one of the most important sectors. We rise and fall on the political economy. If our politics do not facilitate and support by policy, as we've been discussing, then a lot of what we're doing is small. You cannot scale without government. That doesn't mean I personally, Wanjira, have to be in politics. I have very little interest in politics. However, I want to support anybody who puts themselves forward because it's so important. But people who are passionate and excited about politics, we must support. So I tell people, you must either yourself be involved or support people who are. You cannot be a bystander. You have to be in there, either supporting someone, doing some work, or yourself running. So all power to those who are running. I'll be right there supporting them.
We always try to end on a positive soundbite. And no, I want you to speak to the young girl. Let's go both sexes. Normally they leave the boys out. Boy and girl, child, to encourage them to do what you're doing and follow in your footsteps.
Well, identify what you really care about. What do you really care about? I speak to children all the time. Pick, find your passion and stick to it. Build on it, invest in it, speak about it, convince people about it, be willing to die for it.
It's just past 19 hours, 30 minutes and 18 seconds, East African time. Time to stop. Do continue to give us feedback, hopefully positive and reassuring, on the Twitter handle at Capital FM Kenya, or drop us a text or WhatsApp message on 0701-984-984. I've been talking to environment and climate activist Wanjira Maathai, and you've been listening to John Sibiokumu on Wednesday. Thank you once again for doing that most kindly. Much obliged. Until next time.